Welcome to Traveling Culturati, where we explore cultures and share travel news, travel tips, destinations, and travel chats. Visit TravelingCulturati.com for more information.
Well, hey there, fellow Culturati. Javon Harley here, your host and travel pro for Traveling Culturati. Make sure you head on over to the website and join that travel club. Yes, because we go to some fantastic places. Well, welcome back to another week of travel news, travel chats, and travel cultures. I just love sharing with you. In honor of Women's History Month, mother-daughter duo Sophie and Masejo Matsogi of JMT Tours are joining me for their relationship, working together, being mothers and daughters, and running a travel business in South Africa. We also have Javon's Travel Minute and, of course, the Culture Report. But right now, I've got a little travel news. Travel experts are advising individuals to activate the Do Not Disturb function on your phones. You know, it's something I have not used. I do try to ignore messages that come in while I'm driving, but I don't use the Do Not Disturb. And you are kind of compelled to look at that message when it comes through or when it buzzes. And I don't know about you, but on my smartwatch, it buzzes. And so I'm trying to find a way to check it out and not take my eyes off the road. But drivers are being urged to leave their phones and to use the Do Not Disturb feature while driving. If a driver is not hands-free while driving, it is against the law for them to use electrical cars while doing so. It aims to reduce the number of injuries brought on by distracted traveling. More than 11,000 people have been hurt in accidents involving distracted individuals in the position since 2021. Now, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, according to state data, 58% of those were fatal. According to a travel industry specialist, drivers can concentrate on the road and improve health by muting notifications and text messages. According to AAA Northeast spokesperson Mark Shieldrop, it's important for people to think about using it and, you know, to not talk to your friends, loved ones, and colleagues when you're driving. I'm not going to be using this system because I want to be healthy. That's what you can say to them. I want to become aware of what is going on around me. That moment I'm in the car, something that comes in until I'm at my destination. So these are just some of the things that you can say to your friends. But if you have Do Not Disturb on, then they can see that you have the Do Not Disturb. Maybe they should come up with one that says, I'm driving, Do Not Disturb. But since the hands-free law became effective in 2020, an increasing number of citations have been issued. If you are discovered using your phone while driving, you could be fined up to $500. So use the Do Not Disturb. I think I'm going to use that myself. Well, Holland America's Grand World Voyage in 2026 is set to visit all seven continents. Holland America Line is set to set sail, one of its most ambitious Grand World Voyages in 2026. It will be a 132-day cruise, and it'll span all seven continents, including a special four-day Antarctic experience. Details are announced by Holland America President Gus Antorka to 2024 Grand World Voyage guests that were aboard the Zuiderdam, which is currently sailing between Okinawa and Tokyo. The Grand World Voyage will be aboard Volendam in 2026. That's that ship. Providing guests with an intimate experience on one of the cruise line's smaller ships, as well as an opportunity to cruise France's estuary and to visit Bordeaux. The voyage will visit 47 ports across 39 countries on an east-to-west route, sailing round-trip from Fort Lauderdale and traveling as far south as Antarctica and north all the way to Oslo, Norway. The 2026 Grand World Voyage on Volendam is a 132-day voyage departing January 4th 2026. It'll go round trip from Fort Lauderdale. The cruise heads south along the east coast of South America, crossing the equator and sailing down to Antarctica. The ship then makes its way to Easter Island before transversing the islands of the South Pacific en route to Australia. It explores the Great Barrier Reef, Singapore, and the Maldives, then calls at Alexandria, Egypt for an overnight stay before moving through to the Mediterranean and North Europe. It'll then be followed by an Atlantic Ocean crossing. Some of the most memorable moments are expected to be the four-day Antarctic experience. It's going to be a scenic cruising of Chilean Forge, a visit to Easter Island, followed by scenic cruising of Pitcairn Island, and a call at Bordeaux paired with scenic cruising of the Gironde Estuary. 132 days on board, but visiting all seven continents. Not everyone can say they've visited all seven continents. Certainly if you have the time, 132 days on board, and they do have a lot of special amenities and offerings for this voyage. Starting January 4th, 2026, Virgin Voyages have introduced a new and what they're calling fastest internet at sea service. You know, for those that are cruising, often one of the things is internet at sea. Yeah. Virgin Voyages says it will deploy a new level of what they call Pretty Fly for a Wi-Fi connected experience for thousands of its sailors, as they call their guests, across its fleet, becoming the first cruise line to deploy SES Cruise Empowered plus Starlink Pro service, combining medium Earth orbit, which is known as MEO, and low Earth orbit, LEO, satellite coverage. The SES Cruise Empowered plus Starlink Pro service will provide unmatched connectivity of up to 1.5 gigs per ship, enabling Virgin Voyagers sailors to enjoy exclusive guest experiences. It'll be a seamlessly integrated high-performance connectivity service with no data consumption limitations. And it'll power Virgin Voyages' high-end cruise offerings of tech-savvy cabins, beautiful spas, of course, designer suites, plus award-winning entertainment, which all require superior connectivity. Launched in 2021, Virgin Voyages offers adult-only voyages on ships inspired by a boutique hotel experience, sailing to more than 100 ports globally. Yeah, that Wi-Fi is going to be excellent, especially, you know, we like to share on social media, and a lot of times you can't do that real time on cruise ships. You have to wait till you get to certain ports before you can connect to Wi-Fi, but Virgin Voyages is going to change all of that. United is the latest airline to increase baggage fees. Yes, you heard that right. United Airlines just became the latest carrier to increase checked baggage fees this year, implementing the change that will happen over the weekend. Going forward, travelers flying in North America will pay an additional $5 for each checked bag. An airline confirmed this to Travel and Leisure magazine. A first checked bag will now cost $40 or $35 if travelers pay at least 24 hours in advance. So check that bag in advance to save that $5. And a second checked bag will now cost $50 or $45 if you pay in advance. So wait until you get to the airport, you're paying $5 more. This is the first time baggage fees are being raised in 4 years, and added the carrier was in process of installing larger overhead bins for carry-on bags on its mainline aircraft. So basically what's happening is that the overhead compartments are getting taller or deeper so you can stand your bag up on its side, allowing for more carry-on bags to fit in the overhead bins. Now, United will still allow travelers to check a bag for free if they are flying in a premium cabin, are a United Chase credit card holder, a Mileage Plus premium member, or an active military member. The airline will also continue to offer the option to check a first bag for free on long-haul international flights and charge $100 for a second checked bag. United isn't alone in raising the prices for checked bags. Earlier this month, JetBlue increased its own baggage fees by $10, and American Airlines summarily increased its baggage fees. In January, Alaska Airlines also raised checked bags fees by $5. Have you ever gone to a museum, but before you entered, you marveled at the design of the museum itself? So the museum, especially one that is of art, is the attraction in itself. Well, Daily Passport team put together a list of the 6 most architecturally stunning museums around the world. One is the Milwaukee Art Museum in Wisconsin. It has a distinctive white exterior and is also the kind of place you could easily visit for the architecture alone. A trifecta of modern masters is represented, placing the complex squarely on the world stage. It comprises of a modernist cross-shaped war memorial center, David Koller's 1957 Brutalist edition, and Santiago Calatrava's 2001 neo-futurist Quadracci Pavilion, simply referred to as the Calatrava. The latter is the most iconic of the three, so famous, in fact, that it's become a visual stand-in for Milwaukee itself. Then there is the Niterói Contemporary Art Museum in Brazil. Question is often asked, is it a flower or is it a flying saucer? That's how it looks on the outside. But according to the architect, the answer is it's a flower designed by Brazilian avant-garde architect Oscar Niemeyer, one of the founders of modernist movement. The museum, which is nicknamed MAC or MAC by the locals, was completed in 1996. Located across the bay of Guanabara from Rio de Janeiro in the nearby city of Niterói. Now celebrating its 25th anniversary, it's a stunning 4-story circular museum, and it has a permanent collection of more than 1,200 pieces, highlighting some of the country's most iconic contemporary artists. And a lot of visitors arrive by ferry. It's just a 20-minute ferry from Rio de Janeiro. And they come simply to look at the building's architecture, not to even go inside, but it also has some very sweeping views of Sugarloaf Mountain, Guanabara Bay, and the Praia de Boa Viagem Beach. Then there's the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. It is a beautiful building. Roadway and sidewalk leading to it. It's a bronze-colored museum. And the design of the museum is a collaboration of the Freelon Group. Ajaya Associates and Davis Brody Bond wraps the structure in an ornate lattice of bronze-colored metal. It features 3 tiers of inverted half pyramids that invoke the Yoruba crowns of West Africa, the culmination of decades of effort. It's the only national museum entirely dedicated to documenting the contributions of African Americans and examining American history through their lens. Well, that's all I've got for travel news. And when I come back, South African tour operators Sophie and Masego Matsogi will tell us what it's like running a business together and what it's like as women in business in South Africa.
This is Traveling Culturati. We explore cultures and destinations. We share travel news and travel tips to keep you well informed and prepared for your next travel adventure. So go ahead and up your travel game with Traveling Culturati. Visit travelingculturati.com for more information.
Welcome back to the Traveling Culturati. I'm your host and travel pro, Javon Harley. Make sure you head on over to the website. It's travelingculturati.com, and make sure you join that travel club.
And now, Javon's Travel Minute.
Ever think about relocating to another country? How about if they paid you to live there? Why would a destination pay you to live there in their city or their town? It could be for a variety of reasons, like an aging population, a dwindling population, or they're seeking a certain talent, to just name a few reasons. For example, these 3 countries will literally pay you to move abroad. The first place is in Elbingen, Switzerland. They will pay a family of 4 up to 50,000 euro because they have a declining population. Then there's also Prestigio Italy, they will pay up to $25,000 because they have an aging population. The final place that I'm talking about today is the Greek island of Antikythera. This beautiful island currently has about 50 people living there. So if you decide to move there, they will give you a house, a piece of land, and about $500 a month for 3 years because they need people. There are also small towns in the United States offering some incentives to move there. If you don't believe me, just go to your search and put in places that will pay you to move there. You can add the year, for example, if you want to move there right now. You can also add the country or just say internationally if you're looking for international, or you can specify the United States. Yeah, go ahead and check it out. So if you're in the market of moving, you may just want to move to a place that's going to incentivize you to move there. This is Javon, and that was your Travel Minute.
As you know, March is Women's History Month, and we're celebrating women. And today I get the opportunity to chat with two beautiful women that I've known for a very long time. And you're going to discover that in our conversation. Mother and daughter duo, owners and operators of JMT Tours, a tour company in South Africa. And when I tell you they are, I'm going to go back in time and use a word that you probably haven't heard in a long time. They're the bomb diggity of tour operators in South Africa. I have to tell you that. I am chatting with Sophie and Masego Matsogi. Well, good morning, ladies, and welcome to Traveling Culturati.
Good morning. Good morning, Javon. Thank you so much.
Well, again, I want to go back to how long we've known each other. Masego and I were talking as we were waiting for you, Sophie, that she was a little girl when I met her. And now she's a grown woman. But in my mind, I still see her. I still have the picture in my mind of the little girl. Yeah. But it has been amazing to work with both of you. And I really wanted to honor you during Women's History Month. So I want to ask this question of each of you. But Sophie, I want to start with you. How was it growing up in Soweto?
It was amazing. It was mind-blowing. We grew up as a community. I grew up in a big family. We were 8 children, however, 7 left, and I was the second youngest. So we were spoiled. Our parents were not educated, but they learned to provide for us. They could afford the 7 of us. So it was really great growing in Soweto. I miss that community lifestyle that we grew up in. It was a nice growing up.
And that's so good to hear. And when you talk about community, it's so, so, so important. Even when the means are meager, when the community and the family support is there, you don't even notice it as a child. I know I didn't growing up. You were also part of the 76, being in South Africa during that time, a very troubling time. How was that growing up as a little girl?
It was horrific. It was horrific. We experienced all of it. The harassment, the arresting of elder people at that time when they did not have their IDs at the time, called passbooks, in their possession. When you went to a shop, you had to carry that. When you went to your neighbor, you had to carry that, because if those policemen could come across you, going to your neighbor without that, you would be thrown into the back of a pickup van and taken to the police station. I was born and bred in Soweto. So, you know, from a very young age when we became aware of it, maybe let me say from around 9, 10, we started experiencing that, because now our eyes were opening. We heard the name of Mandela, and we were prohibited from even mentioning the name. So that's when we became aware of it, until high school, when we were conscientized.
I see. And Masego, same question to you. How was it growing up in Soweto? Completely different time.
Yeah, I suppose there were some moments of similarity as we were growing up. But firstly, I mean, I was born in the 80s. So when you say the bomb diggity, I get it, because the 90s were high time. But yeah, I mean, with my mom coming from such a big family and my dad's side of the family, what we generally are is, you know, we operate in an extended family kind of setting. So we spent, and it's weird, and I don't know if it's similar where you are, but we tend to gravitate towards the mom's side of the family. So we spent a lot of time with our cousins at my mom's home, as much as my mom, my dad, and my two siblings, whom I know you are aware of as well, and are fair with, who we had our own home. A lot of our time was spent with extended family. You know, we're for the 10-year-old, it's kind of set on one dish and you kind of put in your hands and eat together. So certainly a big sense of community and family. But, you know, throwing back to what my mom was talking about, born in the 80s, there was a state of emergency in 1988. You know, I think I was vaguely aware of what was going on around me at that time. I remember having to leave school through a window because the people were rioting outside. And, you know, I think if I were to smell the smell of tear gas today, I'd be able to recognize it for what it is, because it still was quite rife, the energy. And obviously Mandela being released the year he was, there was that experience. But I think my experience had a duality of great and that somberness that kind of led us to a South Africa that we know today. So in short, I'd say it was very interesting, but it's shaped a lot of my ways of viewing life and taking in life and operating in the day that we are in what is known to be a new South Africa, if I can call it that.
Oh, absolutely. So you were there during the lingering effects and then, of course, the changes. My first visit to South Africa was in 98, and then I brought my first group in 99. And then I believe it was 2 or 3 years after that, maybe 2001 or 2002, we started working with JMT Tours, and we've been working with you ever since. So again, the electric vibe of what was happening and what was changing, the new South Africa was happening during that time as well. And yeah. I've seen tourism grow exponentially since then, especially still honoring Soweto and the other parts of South Africa so that we're not looking at it through one lens. So I really appreciate JMT Tours for sharing that with us and sharing that with our travelers that have come over so that we are getting a broader story. So Sophie, what were your aspirations as a little girl? What was it that you wanted to be when you grew up?
Growing up, the most common professions when we grew up, it was teaching and nursing. So I was set to be a nurse until after I completed my matric, and my dad said, no ways you're going to do that. It's not made for our family. So that changed the whole perspective and the direction. So at that point, I diverted and went to university to study social work. But due to financial constraints, because there were riots at that time, during that year when I started university, that was in 1977, we had to be returned home several times because, you know, there would be uprisings. I went to the University of the North, which is known as Tafelkop. So we would be expelled and went home back to Johannesburg, called back. It was those up and down. So, you know, it put financial constraints on the parents. So I could not continue after that. And then I had to find work, which I did in a commercial bank. I worked there until my late husband convinced me to join him in tourism, which I don't regret because it got to be my passion. I enjoy tourism. So it's totally different from what I had intended to do in my life. And I'm sure if tourism was popular at that time, I would have chosen it from the first time.
It's always amazing to hear people's stories and what they aspired to be when they were children and then what they became. And so many times we fall into those roles, but those are sometimes the best roles that we have. And certainly want to honor Joe Matsogi as well. And so he convinced you to get into travel and tourism. When did you and Joe meet?
We met in a classroom in matric in 1975. And it started until death did us part. So we were 46 years together when Joe passed on.
Oh, wow. And what grade was that?
We were in grade 12. We were actually together in the class from grade, at that time it was known as standard, in actual fact forms. So grade 12 was known as form 5 and grade 11 was known as form 4. So we met in form 4. but only came to fall in love in Form 5, which is grade 12 in 1975.
Masejo, same question. What were your aspirations as a little girl? What were you thinking of?
Yeah, I'll tell you that my parents probably thought I was crazy. If you know the setup in Soweto and how tightly built the houses are, you'll understand why there's a level of berserkness or craziness to the aspiration that I had. So I wanted a horse. And I was adamant that that's what I wanted and wanted to live by. But I think part of that was also wanting to be a onstage artist. When I had a vision of what I wanted to do later in life, I literally had Brenda Fassie in my mind. This was at a much younger age. But as you go through school and you go through guidance lessons and they teach you about careers, I thought that I was going to go into mechanical engineering. What my mom hasn't told me was the fact that what her dad did to her is what my dad and her did to me. And it was not because mechanical engineering then was not a popular thing. If anything, at school, we were encouraged to go into being into medicine or engineering, the STEM kind of subjects and career choices. But when I finished matric, I think, you know, sometimes people may know you better than you know yourself, especially at that age. And my parents at that time were up and coming, quite fluid, and had a crowd around them that knew things that I didn't necessarily get to know in school. And so they recommended that I go for a visit at McCann Erickson, which I know is an American part of it. In fact, I went to their buildings out in New York the one day. But it was really to immerse me in the world of advertising. And eventually that's what I ended up studying. I went to college and I studied advertising, and it's a career choice that I then made and worked myself up in the industry, but at the same time, always working with my parents. And I think being in the marketing field and advertising field has also in parts helped the business JMT Tour specifically to raise a profile and help put the word out there about the kind of company it is and what it does. So in short, it was always creativity at a young age. And I think that was my true calling. It ended up not being on stage, but rather in the background and doing crazy creative things, which have also helped JMT Tours, which I'm proud of.
Yes. So acting, I'm guessing, was your stage.
Mind you, no, actually, I wanted to sing without a singing voice. So I'm glad that I was veered away from that.
So from an equestrian to a singer, to a mechanical engineer, to advertising and marketing, to now working with your mom in the family business and JMT Tours. And I can see how certainly entertainment and advertising and marketing would really help in this lane.
Mm. Absolutely. You know, that's what a lot of people don't necessarily have, even to this day, the understanding of the goings on within that kind of business and how the machinations of it work. So I'm glad it's something that I can offer the business. And it's incredible because, yes, you're speaking to me and my mom, but we've got our sister. I've got my sister as well, who's into finances, and my brother, who actually does the tours himself. You know, when we were speaking earlier, Javon, I was saying how incredibly amazing my mom has run this business, even after my dad's passing, which is pretty recent, but still, they really made the soul of this business. But that, in fact, there's a group that I follow because they were We Can. It's really that, you know, they have built us to be these, you know, it sounds kind of crazy that I'm going to say people are building us, but these are parents who have done an incredible job of building such a formidable company, which has led to where it is. And I mean, what, 25 years on, and that we can add the value that we can is an honor and a privilege, quite honestly.
Well, and it's one of the reasons we have continued to work with JMT Tours, and it gives that community sense, the company itself, but the people behind the company having a family business. And from day one, we've always been communicating with Sophie and knowing that the role that she's playing. So Joe was in the front. And so Sophie, was that the lane that you wanted to be in to say, I want to handle the administration of the business and making sure, because the administration is the most important part of the business.
In actual fact, when I left the bank, I had trained already as a tourist guide and as a tour operator. So I started guiding then and doubling up with the admin. But because I had been in the bank for a long time and I actually enjoyed admin, and I hated to see an admin that did not go according to what it was supposed to be. So I decided I'm going to handle my admin and seeing with other tour operator, the unprofessionalism that was there, not answering emails, it pushed me to be on admin 100%. In the bank, we learned to say, you know, that you had to have to put limit to your response time. So that pushed me to, even before I left the bank, because my husband started the business whilst I was still in the employ of the bank, I had to come back from work and do admin. But it used to eat me up during the day when I was at work and knowing that there was an email that was pending. So it really drove me to focus on admin and respond in time.
It's the most important because, as you said, and the reason that you wanted to take care of that and to make sure that the administration part of the business was working properly is because you could be great out in the field. You can be great in front of everyone. But if it's not supported with the logistical part or the part that is connecting to the money and the people and responsive time and all of that, it's extremely important and it goes hand in hand. You can't have one without the other. And that's where you lose business if you're not doing those things. So as I said, from day one, we've always communicated with you by email. We met Joe when we arrived, but we were communicating with you prior to that to get everything arranged. And we're still doing that today. What role are you in, Masejo?
So as I mentioned, with my background, I generally do the marketing of the business and just general administration. What I do want to do, and it's a conversation I've had with my mom, is get onto the field because I think that's where the heart is. That's where we learn. And I suppose, you know, with TK, kind of carry that because I think there are so many stories to be told still about South Africa that can be told slightly different to how we are generally have, you know, with time and change of scenery. I believe that there is a different kind of story to be told. So in the short term, I'm still doing the marketing of the business, but long term, it's to be more ingrained in the business and actually being in field and telling true stories about South Africa and stories that'll get people here and get to understand us as a people. And that's really the role at heart.
How has it been working together?
Look, I mean, I think it's got its pros and cons, but I think opportunity is rife to do amazing things and to brainstorm wild ideas and have the latitude to do that, to deliver on those, because there's no bureaucracy that comes with that. I think coming from different generations will obviously have an impact on how we communicate, but I think with one goal in mind, we do try to see eye to eye. My mom talks about admin and how she's a stickler for that. And I'm learning, I will put it in a positive way, manner, that she's a great tutor and teacher in that regard. So I think if anything, it's probably that, how quickly one responds to things that one I'm learning quite a lot from. And her coming from a bank background, it's also about the finances, making sure that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. Yeah, I'd say most enjoyable, but it's got its challenges like any other business. But I think putting our best foot forward and knowing why we're doing this. For us, it's not just a livelihood. It's about telling the story of a country that we love so dearly. And I think we always arrive back at that. And there's slight challenges. I wouldn't say it's challenges that drive us to a wage at any point. But yeah, generational differences certainly do come in place. Sometimes I want to say, use a certain kind of language on our social media pages. And my mom will say, no, that's not how you do it. But we do find a middle ground because I think the train is moving and we want to move with it, even though we don't want to necessarily be wild about it.
Well, I just know, like the relationship with my mom, while it's not a professional relationship, I know the channels that we go through or how we view our mom. You know, when we're little girls, we revere them and they're these big people to us. And then we become teenagers and we think we know everything. And we think we know much more than our mother knows. And then we come back when we get older and we really sit and listen. And then we realize how much our moms really know. And we go back to how awesome they are. So I know in probably a professional dynamic, you run the course of all of those emotions as well.
Completely, 100%.
So Sophie, how has the dynamic been having Masriho and some of your other children working with you?
It is actually fulfilling. You can run the ideas to them anytime you like. However, the challenge is that, you know, as a family, there is no limit that, you know, this is after work, we cannot talk work. You talk work until you go to bed. So it is actually fulfilling to work together.
Yes, and Jean and I, you know, working together as well, we always say, okay, let's just have some personal time and not talk about business, and we'll go to dinner. And then after about 20 minutes, we're talking business. Yeah. It becomes hard to separate it all the time. So what has been the biggest challenge, would you say?
In working together.
Yes, in working together.
Not much really, except for lack of time limit. There hasn't been that much challenge. Maybe Masuha could say, but as far as it comes to my mind, I haven't experienced any big challenges. Mm-hmm. Maybe the arguments, you know, like when brainstorming, however, nothing much.
That's really good to know. And it's a learning process. And so welcoming, especially when you're talking about social media, that has created a whole new lane in marketing, you know, the digital marketing space. Certainly when we started our business, which was also 25 years ago, social media marketing and email marketing or even digital marketing wasn't really considered, you know, a thing, but now it's a thing of its own. So it must be great to have that next generation that understands social media a bit more than we do to come in and take care of that, especially one that has gone to school for advertising and marketing.
Definitely, definitely. It is of great help.
So what have you learned from Masuha in this process?
I have learned that I should not limit myself. You always want to go big. We argue and eventually I condescend. And she's always pushing for me to think big and, you know, not limit myself or the company from growing. So those are the big lessons I have learned from my daughter.
That's a big lesson. And that's a beautiful lesson as well. Masuha, the same question. What have you learned from Sophie?
I mean, discipline, I'll say, Javon. When you go back to her introduction about where she comes from, you'll understand how important Africa is to her and my late dad.
That's a really beautiful thing to say. Discipline and the love of what you do and the love of country. That's extremely, extremely powerful statement. So this may evoke some emotions here, but Sophie, what do you want for your daughter and granddaughter? Because I know you have the next generation as well, and especially as women.
Okay. What I wish for my daughters and my grandchildren, it's for them to be independent, not to rely on anyone for their achievement. You build your own future. So they should not limit themselves. They should work as hard as they can, especially working for yourself. Nothing restricts you. So I wish for them not to be restricted, to grow as far as they want. The sky should be their limit. So basically it's independence, growing to be an independent person.
Absolutely. Masuha, how many children do you have?
I've got a busy four-year-old, a very busy four-year-old, and that's just one child.
One daughter.
Yeah, one daughter.
And what do you want for her?
Ooh, Javon, coming from the history that we've come from, and I know that the world still operates in a manly form, I want her to be confident in herself. I want her to be knowledgeable, and I want her to be able to do things and know that she can, even with the background she comes from. More than anything, I desire for her to have a voice and know her place, and not knowing her place by finding herself in a box, but know that she is firmly rooted in this world. She can move as she will, do what she can that is good and enhances her as a human being. Yeah, I just wish her greatness. I think I've had the privilege of being my parents' child and being exposed to so much. And that is important for me as well, to have exposure, go out there and fly and be fabulous and know that she has a strong back in her family and that she can be whatever she wants, she desires to be in the world. And not just in South Africa, but the world. Exposure, knowledge, and understand the world as well. That's what I desire for her.
Sophie and Masuha, it's been such an honor and a pleasure speaking with you today and sharing your stories with us. And I just want everyone to know JMT Tours is an awesome company. And we've said this throughout, and you've heard us talk about our experiences in South Africa. And we would never come to Johannesburg or South Africa and not use JMT Tours. And I'll go back to my other word, the bomb diggity. And all of our travelers have always come back with rave reviews as well. So thank you for those wonderful experiences. Thank you for continuing and bringing in the next generation so that JMT Tours is going to continue for the years to come. And we bring in the next generation with the experience and knowledge that we have of South Africa.
Thank you, Javon, for having us. And thank you for trusting us. We'll keep giving the best service that you know. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Javon.
My pleasure. When we come back, I'll have the culture report.
This is Traveling Culturati. We explore cultures and destinations. We share travel news and travel tips to keep you well informed and prepared for your next travel adventure. So go ahead and up your travel game with Traveling Culturati. Visit travelingculturati.com for more information.
Welcome back to the Traveling Culturati. I'm your host and travel pro, Javon Harley. Make sure you head on over to the website, travelingculturati.com, and make sure you join the travel club so that you can travel to some fantastic places with us. Culture is forever changing and reflecting what's happening in the society and with its people. It can be born of the arts, music, food, and sometimes politics and strife. This is the Culture Report. I have the honor and pleasure of chatting with Azeb Tadesi, who is a seasoned education and African affairs professional with over 20 years of diverse experience. Hello, Azeb, and welcome to Traveling Culturati.
Hello, Javon, and thank you for having me here.
Absolutely a pleasure. I love highlighting and speaking with women who are doing things, especially for women and women of color. I think that as we travel, we should travel with intention and pay attention to our surroundings and the people that we meet and the cultures that we encounter along the way. Let's talk a little bit about your body of work and what is bringing you to us today.
Thank you. Yes, I was born in Ethiopia, but kind of grew up mainly in Europe, one place in West Africa. My father worked for Ethiopian Airlines, which if you're a traveler in Africa, you know the airlines. And we went with him. He took us with him when he was stationed from place to place. And he used to always tell us that this is what he's leaving for us, education, and not only in the classroom, but also in the world. And that has impacted, I think, for the most part, me and my siblings in terms of wanting to explore new places, kind of given us the little boost we needed to explore areas. We came to the U.S. during the Dirk time, which a lot of Ethiopians left. And we settled in Los Angeles for the most part. All of us, me, my sister, my brother, ended up at UCLA. And that's where I began studying Africa, first as a history major, and then I did the master's in African studies. And I continued working at UCLA, working on projects in Africa, working on research and think pieces on the continent. And you get to have solo conversations about why something is some way, and also conversations with some of the great thinkers that I personally admire. And it just snowballed, I guess, is what we can say.
I find it very interesting, you being from Ethiopia and then coming to the United States to study African history.
We grew up in Europe, so a lot of our history was basically wherever we were at that time, either Germany or London. And when selecting our career choice in college, we were wondering, what can we do? Of course, our parents being African parents, they wanted doctors, they wanted engineers, they wanted accountants, they wanted you to have a stable career moving forward. And then I sort of was gravitating to the social sciences and history. So I wanted to do political science. History was a compromise with my father and my mother. My parents were very welcoming. So given the political context of Ethiopia, my parents were like, what are you going to do with poli-sci? And I said, okay, then I'm going to do history. And they're like, okay, fine.
You're currently leading the Women in Action Network What exactly is the Women in Action Network?
So I'm currently at the UCLA Capacity Building Center with my colleagues, Dr. Walter Allen and Dr. Claudia Mitchell-Kernan. And we basically, for the most part, focus on capacity development at institutional levels with universities and more established government organizations. But on one trip about 2019, I ended up in Ghana, and you know, I've always loved shea butter, but just could not get into what I was finding in the stores here. And somebody was saying, oh, you know, shea butter is made here in the north. And I was like, really? Can I get some? And they said, yeah. And I was like, okay. I mean, I don't know how many pounds I need or anything, but it just so happens that my colleague at that time, his friend was a development officer, Ghanaian colleagues, was a development officer in the upper north. And he was working with these group of women who are hand producing shea butter. And I said, okay, you know, just send it to me. I mean, whatever you have. And the price wasn't so bad. I was like, I don't know what 75 kilos looks like, but just send it and we'll figure out what to do with it. Because that's all what the women had. And it would have just made their day to have it. So they sent it and it was absolutely the best that I've seen. So soft, odorless, and it just went on smoothly. And I was surprised, you know, when I was telling my other colleagues, like, I can't believe that these women make such high quality products and they can't find buyers for them. They basically sell them on barter basis if they are lucky, because there isn't much of a market up north and they don't have the access to export. And so, you know, I brought it back with me to the US. I only had a carry-on, so three of my luggages were shea butter. And I remember seeing the Delta guys looking at it and saying, Madame, you're going to take all these? I said, just, you know, let's take it. Let's see where it goes. You know, I bought it from the village women and came to the US and I started sharing it with my friends. Everybody loved it. And we just were like, this can't be, like, there has to be something we can do. And one of my mentors and friends that is heads up the USA for Africa, the organization that manages We Are the World. And they work very closely with, they try to support African-based projects. And I told her about this experience. I gave her some of the shea butter. And I said, look, I'd like to do something with these women. Could you fund a little startup? And my colleague in Ghana, so all of us just came together. She would provide the funding and the advice. And we would go and have a meeting with the women, getting consent from them, like, would you like some help? And this is what we can help you with. And would you like to expand it? And they were enthusiastic. And so since that day, she's been funding the construction of a shea processing center, because that's one of the issues in that region. And so this is a network. We decided to set up this network of women who are engaged in small scale enterprise, but can't seem to get to the next level because of structural obstacles, not having the funds to build a processing center, even though your skills are just amazing and your products are way above and beyond than what we would find in the market, or skill sets to run cooperatives. So that's our objective. We'll create like these network of women engaged in these income producing activities, just build their capacity, meaning fill the gap. Where is the gap that we need to fill to get them to the next level? And it's out of our range, meaning we're not used to working at that level, but the women have been fabulous. They're enthusiastic. It's a 50-50 initiative. We could provide some of the funding. Maybe we have a little workshop listening to them, what they need to go to the next step. And our partners on the ground who are not paid as well, this is a free service they provide, our intermediaries. And we're hoping to get it to the next level now because the women have reached a point where they see the value of the products they're producing and people around them are willing to support them, from the chief who's so supportive to the WA administration. And so what we hope to do is get them to a point where they're producing these high quality shea butter that we can export or get into hotels first on the continent, not export too far out, but provide an avenue for them to get their products out there and earn income for their families.
So let's talk about the Shea Festival. I had never heard of the Shea Festival. So tell us about that.
So we are working in the middle of two villages, and then we ended up, you know, approaching another one a bit further away. And so, as I stated earlier, that area is sparsely populated. And so one of the things that came to mind is that instead of us going to each village and having this conversation, a yearly opportunity to bring all the women together, bring them all together with their shea butter, and then, of course, talk to all our networks and contacts and say, look, you know, would you like to come to Ghana? And this year it's going to be April 27th. And come to Ghana and maybe attend this festival and buy shea butter directly from the women. So we're treating it like a community forum as well as a market. So bringing the women together so they can talk to each other, they can talk about their experience, they can talk about their process and the challenges and the benefits that they've seen. And then also having researchers, because there's this innovative, eco-friendly method for producing shea butter, bringing in those experts so they can have a conversation and talk about new ways of approaching this processing. And then bringing in maybe some of the regional officers, because there is funding. It's just that the women may not know about it. And of course, we don't know about it. There's funding maybe within the government infrastructure that the women can access specifically for that region. And of course, bringing in buyers, small scale, large scale. And all of this is to create awareness, not only in the community, about women's enterprise. So shea butter is women's gold, right, in the region, because women make this. But bringing awareness to the community that this is not just women's work that, you know, you should just leave it in the back, but it's something we should invest in because it has the potential to grow the community. And then for the buyers, it's an opportunity for them to really try remarkable shea butter and perhaps buy directly from the women. It's the first year. We're calling it the Upper West Region Shea Festival, but we're hoping to make it a tourist destination and people will come in and take part in this vibrant festival.
How do we get more information on the Shea Festival?
The Shea Festival information is also on the website, womeninactionafrica.org. And there's an opportunity to sponsor women, like $100 sponsors for women. But also, you can email us. You know, I keep talking about the quality of the shea butter. I really was not a shea butter fan before this, before I saw what the shea butter the women were having. And it's because of the process. I mean, I learned this from other cooperatives in the region. There's a huge difference between what the women produce by hand and what factories produce in terms of not only the quality, but also its healing and just therapeutic abilities. So if people are looking for organic, natural products to add to personal care products they're making, we're more than happy to talk to them about purchasing directly from the women.
Fantastic. Well, Azeb, thank you so much for joining me today and sharing such wonderful information, and especially that we can make sure that this is part of our International Women's History Month.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ladies and gentlemen!
This is Traveling Culturati. We explore cultures and destinations. We share travel news and travel tips to keep you well informed and prepared for your next travel adventure. So go ahead and up your travel game with Traveling Culturati. Visit travelingculturati.com for more information.